The question that was going around from the Americans to the world was, who are they and why do they hate us?
About 20 states have seen their tuition levels this last year go up in double-digit numbers. And that's solely a function of economic hardship.
And then we got to send our kids to die, too. I say let's ask Bush to send his daughters first, and then I'll think about sending mine.
Their ranks are divided between the Chicken Littles and then the people who have to come in and clean up the chicken coop.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, December 12, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A front page headline in today's Washington Post reads, U.S. suspects Al-Qaeda got nerve agent from the Iraqis. The article cites administration sources claiming a connection between Osama bin Laden of Al-Qaeda and Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. William Rivers Pitt is a political analyst and co-author of What the Bush Team Doesn't Want You to Know. He says the claim that Saddam and Al-Qaeda have connections is laughable. We spoke with him earlier about the Post article claiming exactly that.
Somebody came out with this report that Iraq has Al-Qaeda connections, and that ended up on the front page of the Washington Post and the Boston Globe, and has, I'm sure, been being talked about on a lot of the cable news stations, but CNN has put forth a report from a number of other senior administration officials that would seem to suggest that these reports are not, in fact, accurate. They're not grounded in any facts, and they've backed off of it.
And you, in fact, describe Saddam Hussein as a secular dictator, and you say bin Laden has said he'd like to see Saddam dead. You don't think that the possibility of them having any connection is anything grounded in anything other than fantasy, I guess.
Saddam Hussein describes himself as a secular dictator, as a socialist, by the way he views the world, and has been viciously repressing Islamic fundamentalism in his own country for the last 30 years, particularly the Wahhabi sect of Islam, which is practiced by many members of Al-Qaeda and by Osama bin Laden. There are laws on the books in Iraq requiring a death sentence for anyone who proselytizes fundamentalist Islam in his country. And yes, as you stated, members of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden in particular have said on many occasions that they would like to see Saddam Hussein dead. The idea that Saddam Hussein would deliver such potent weapons to individuals who have basically put a death sentence on his head seems far-fetched, to say the least.
We know, or we've said for decades, for centuries, that politics have been known to make strange bedfellows. You think it's inconceivable that Osama and Saddam could perhaps agree on, maybe they could agree on one thing, that they hate the Bush administration or George Bush enough, their hatred for him supersedes any kind of personal animosity or that they might have for each other.
I think anything is possible. I think it's just as possible that Saddam Hussein could take his weapons and make alliance with a Timothy McVeigh type of character to deliver those weapons to America. I mean, when you speak in possibilities, the world is wide open, but to a large extent, we have to restrict ourselves to the facts at hand. When we deal in possibilities, we leave open the door for fear and hysteria and action that is not grounded in reality and will, in fact, do more harm than good.
And so the facts speak to the fact that no relationship between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein exists.
No relationship has been established, and people have been working overtime to establish such a relationship. It occurs to me that the fact that this story was put forth in all likelihood by the White House, that Saddam Hussein and Iraq have given these terrible weapons to Al-Qaeda, and then immediately, promptly, somebody goes and backs off that story entirely, suggests either one of two things. Either this administration can't seem to get its message straight, and that the ranks are divided between the Chicken Littles and then the people who have to come in and clean up the chicken coop. Or we're dealing with a situation where the Bush administration has run out of the ability to establish that connection and is now putting forth stories like this.
Well, meanwhile, the White House plans to announce tomorrow, we're told through an article in the Washington Post, that military personnel and emergency responders will receive smallpox vaccines as early as next week. That kind of lays the groundwork. What's your reaction?
Well, it's troubling. I think that the smallpox vaccine is a pretty dangerous piece of medicine. It's going to make a lot of people sick. It's a pretty enormous step, as you said, towards war. I worry for the individuals who will have to receive these shots. I know there have been a number of American soldiers who have chosen to have themselves removed from the military instead of, as opposed to take that shot. Actually, it might be the anthrax vaccine that I'm thinking of.
I believe so, yes.
To a certain extent, we're talking about the same part of the jungle here. But I think it's disquieting.
You have written a book along with Scott Ritter titled What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know. What are some of the top issues that Team Bush doesn't want Americans to know?
Well, I think the aforementioned lack of a connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, specifically the idea that Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda are pretty much mortal enemies at this point, is something the Bush administration does not discuss and, in fact, has propounded otherwise, as evidenced by this story that came out today. They do not discuss the fact that the inspection regime that was operative between 1991 and 1998 was incredibly effective and destroyed basically all of Hussein's chemical weapons infrastructure and virtually every bit of weaponry that he had available to him. But the problem here is that the chemical weapons that he was manufacturing have a shelf life of 5 years, so that anything he might have been able to hide away is now garbage. And when you combine that with the fact that his entire infrastructure for manufacturing this stuff was destroyed and that he would have to spend billions of dollars on protected technology that we keep a very close eye on in order to reconstitute it, leads one to believe that, in fact, the threat from Saddam Hussein is not nearly as significant as we have been led to believe.
We also see reports today that the U.S. is trying to stop shipments of atropine headed to Iraq. The Bush administration is apparently concerned that Baghdad may be stockpiling this antidote for nerve agents in case Iraq launches a chemical attack if we go to war against them. They're afraid Iraq will have the antidote for its soldiers. Is there a relationship between Saddam Hussein and the U.S. that the Bush team doesn't want Americans to know about?
We have a long history with Saddam Hussein and that region and the nation of Iraq, going back all the way to the Nixon administration in 1972 when Iraq basically nationalized its own oil and the Nixon administration put them on the terrorist watch list. And they started arming the Kurds in 1975 when Iraq ceded control of the Shatab al-Arab waterway, a very strategically important waterway, back to Iran, which at that point was basically a client state of the United States. Iraq was taken off the terrorist watch list and the Kurds were stopped. The administration stopped arming the Kurds. In 1979, when the Shah was overthrown by the Ayatollah Khomeini, Iraq suddenly became a very good friend of ours. And by 1984, we had not only removed them from the terrorist watch list, but we were arming them, giving them all sorts of biological and chemical weapons, the likes of which we are now very much afraid of, and sharing our tactical and strategic information for battlefield usage of these weapons. There's a report in a New York Times article that was cited in my book that describes American intelligence officials on the battlefield where the Iraqis took back the Fal Peninsula in 1988 and found these vials of atropine all over the battlefield, indicating that, in fact, chemical weapons had been used and the Iraqi soldiers had inoculated themselves against it in order to protect against the possibility of those weapons blowing back across their lines. These are the kind of things that are not widely discussed, but they are very, very important to the reality we find ourselves in. The history of Iraq and the United States did not begin in 1990. We've been dealing with this region for a number of decades.
Did the U.S. know about these shipments of atropine to Iraq prior to today? And if so, had it made any attempts to try to stop them before?
Not that I have heard about. It's possible that they knew. I think they certainly knew of the shipments from 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. But as for recent ones, I don't know. It's interesting that the first question that you had that you asked me was the one I had a funny feeling that you would, the one about the Washington Post report about the transfer of weapons. I think it's a very disturbing fact that this has taken place, that this was put forward and then immediately retracted. That's a bell that to a certain extent it will be difficult to unring, particularly if the retraction does not receive nearly as much play as the initial statement. I hope that it does, because I think it's very important that people understand that this threat that has been put out there has been disavowed by the very administration that put it out there in the first place.
And so it's your opinion, perhaps, that it's deliberately planted.
I worry that may be the case, because we're in a situation right now where they are talking about having this secret, absolutely indisputable evidence that Iraq possesses these weapons, but they won't share it with the American people, they won't share it with you in the media, and perhaps most disturbingly, they won't share it with the weapons inspectors who are being tasked to find the stuff in the first place. One would think that information would be useful to them and would serve the purposes of the Bush administration, but they're not sharing it. I worry that it does not really exist, and I worry that we are being led into a war situation based solely upon the word of Mr. Bush, and that is no way to go about business.
Well, your suggestion or your concerns that perhaps the story was planted would suggest that there's a conspiracy between certain reporters at the Washington Post and the Bush administration, would it not?
I don't know that it's necessarily a conspiracy. I think that in no small respect, we're dealing with an administration that is not terribly friendly to the press and has made it known that it's not terribly friendly to the press. If you have your career in mind as a journalist and you like your chair in the White House office or in the White House
press room,
journalism pool, and if you go and knock over some sacred cows, you're going to find yourself frozen out and you're going to find yourself unable to do your job, and that's the end of that.
And so therefore they would write a story that might further the means to an end for the Bush administration.
They are writing what the Bush administration is telling them. And to a certain extent, that's a journalist's job. If you are told by the White House that such and such is true and it's a serious enough story, it will wind up on the front page of your paper. And that's not a journalist necessarily failing to do their job. But if you have a situation where the information that you've been giving is not entirely accurate, which is absolutely the case in this matter, as evidenced by the fact that they have since retracted it, you have a team of journalists who are being led down the primrose path.
Okay.
They're just doing their jobs and they're not being given the information in an accurate way.
William Rivers Pitt and former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter have co-authored the book, What the Bush Team Doesn't Want You to Know. The last U.S. diplomat to meet with Saddam Hussein held a press-only briefing today in Washington, offering what he calls insights on the Iraqi leader's game plan. Ambassador Joe Wilson was the U.S. charge d'affaires in Baghdad on the eve of the Gulf War. He's credited with having gained the release of Americans and other hostages after Iraq invaded Kuwait. Wilson is critical of Bush's approach to regime change, and he bases his opinion on firsthand experiences with Saddam Hussein.
The Saddam Hussein I know is really a bad guy. He is a thug of the first order. His regime is one of the two most oppressive regimes in the world today, the other one being North Korea. The world would clearly be better off without it. Everything that everybody has asserted about Saddam Hussein and his regime is right, fundamentally. Even if some of the facts may be inaccurate, it is a bad regime. Its human rights record is abysmal. I think it's also safe to say, and I will stipulate for the purposes of this discussion, that information that we have suggests strongly that he has active programs designed to develop weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, and nuclear. We know beyond a doubt that he has weaponized chemical weapons. He used them in the war against Iran. He has used them against the Kurds in Halabja and other places in Kurdistan. We know that that his efforts to weaponize biological precursors may have been successful. We also know, I think, with the exception of perhaps Scott Ritter, that he also is actively pursuing nuclear weapons. Let me also say up front that regime change is a reasonable policy objective. Regime change is a policy objective that the United States has had in place that that does not necessarily translate into a mandate to put together a force of 250,000 people to conquer a foreign country, decapitate its administration, occupy its country, try and pacify the country, and try to, as Charles Krauthammer put it in a symposium I attended and participated in on Monday, try to change the value systems within that society. Now, the arguments for it, and I'll be very brief on this because I know you've all heard it, but the argument for it that was put forward essentially from September 12th of 2001, the day after the World Trade Center, the events of September 11th were bad. Saddam Hussein is a bad man. Ergo, we should kill Saddam Hussein. This sort of action that is poorly understood in the rest of the world, and we all sit here in Washington where we believe as mantra that he's got these weapons of mass destruction, but you go outside to Latin America, you go to Africa, you go to Asia, they don't believe it. And they're not going to believe it until we bring the Adlai Stevenson proof to the table. So this is going to be viewed in a good part of the world as American aggression. Would it mean the emergence of another generation of disaffected, not just Arab, but Muslim, who was prepared to kill or die in the name of Saddam Hussein, who had confronted the West? Yeah, probably would. So yeah, I think you would at a minimum see another generation of disaffected Arab being drawn into a terrorist fight against the United States, asymmetric battle against the United States, and that would grow as we were occupying Iraq. Occupation begets resistance.
Peace Watch producer Reem Kathuta from WPFW in Washington, D.C. attended the briefing and questioned Wilson about the administration's claim that Iraq is a threat to the U.S.
Reports from the CIA and other intelligence agencies says that the only way Saddam would be attacking the United States would be if the United States attacks it.
I think the intelligence community is on the money. It's certainly inconsistent with every experience that we have had, that Saddam Hussein, above all, is a survivor, or, as I would put it, a survivalist, that he values his own survival above everything else. That is certainly, it should be an operating principle as we go forward on this. The question to Saddam Hussein should be, his second objective, of course, is to survive in a way that allows him to leverage power over the region and to be a bigger man than he currently is. The question to him really is, do you value your survival above valuing your weapons of mass destruction? Now, I think it's equally clear, and the Iraqis have made this clear to me on any number of occasions, that in extremis, they would do anything that they had to do. And I think in the case of Saddam, because I do believe that he, in his own mind, embodies the sort of l'état c'est moi spirit. I think that's what allows him to put hundreds of thousands of Iraqis to their deaths in futile wars against Iran and Kuwait without a second thought. But that also will allow him, I think, to fight to the bitter end. And I think also that he is probably looking at his place in history in the event that this does go down to a total war. And I think that that's what's driving him to try and portray this again as an Iraqi defense of the Arab nation against a Western aggressor. I think that he would like to go down in the pantheon of Arab heroes whose sole claim to fame is that they were prepared to stand up to the West.
Can you give us tangible examples of what you think Iraq at this point in history is a threat to the United States, and also what allows the United States to have this total disrespect of sovereignty, and you would advocate extraterritorial interference, like you said, in Iraq, Libya, and Cuba?
Two areas, and they're related, that we can really point to as real threats to our national security interests are, one, his possession and his active participation in programs of mass destruction, and two, his flagrant disregard of UN Security Council resolutions, but particularly the one on weapons of mass destruction. And I think that if we focus our efforts on just obtaining those two objectives, we have clarity of objective, then we can achieve that goal without having to do what you have said, exercise something that I think in the region would be terribly unpopular, would redound not in our favor whatsoever, and that is, as I like to call it, because I think regime change is just too easy a way to talk about it. We're talking about the conquest, the decapitation of a regime, the pacification, occupation of a nation that is foreign to ours. I mean, this is truly an imperial act.
Israel has disrespected the United Nations resolution time and again. Should the United States attack it for that?
It is really in our national security interest that we act in this case. And our national security interests are engaged when you're talking about weapons of mass destruction. And that is not the case of 242 and 338 in this particular view of the situation.
U.S. Ambassador Joe Wilson addressing a Washington press corps. That segment was prepared by WPFW's Reem Kathuta, Matt Bradley, and Ingrid Drake. Estimates on the cost of war with Iraq vary greatly, depending on which economists you ask. Yale University professor William Nordhaus released a study earlier this week estimating the cost of a war with Iraq could cost American taxpayers anywhere from $99 billion to $1.9 trillion. Julian Malveau, the co-editor of The Paradox of Loyalty, an African-American Response to the War on Terrorism, which is a collection of essays written by various African-Americans addressing the impact of September 11th and the war on terrorism. She suspects that a war will not only have a direct impact on the budget, but will also have a ripple effect throughout society, particularly targeting people of color and members of poorer communities.
If we do significant borrowing, we'll see differences in the interest rate. Interest rates are likely to edge up. We've enjoyed a very robust expansion, especially in our housing markets with low interest rates. And many middle-income Americans, while their salaries have been stagnant, have had increased spending power because they've been able to refinance their homes at lower rates. Those kinds of things begin to go out of the window when we look at increasing interest rates. And if we have to do borrowing for the war, that is what will happen. We are in a deficit situation, of course. Mr. Bush took us from a surplus to a deficit, and in doing so has made the economic climate for going to war much more difficult. The other thing that tends to happen is that the states will see enormous hardship, and we're seeing that already. We're seeing states who do not have the same flexibility that the federal government has now having to raise taxes, to raise college tuitions. I mean, one of the tragedies, I think, for people of color has been that about 20 states have seen their tuition levels this last year go up in double-digit numbers. And that's solely a function of economic hardship, which is likely to tighten because of war.
Well, now we know, I believe, that people tend to get skittish in their spending habits during war times, and there's a correlation between the economy and unemployment figures. What effect is an attack on Iraq likely to have on the overall economy and unemployment? You just addressed some of those, some effects, the interest rates rising, et cetera. But what about unemployment? How does that factor in?
Well, the unemployment rate is now 6%. It's higher than it's been in about 8 years. If we go to war, there is likely to be some employment effect in terms of people perhaps being employed in terms of military manufacturing. And that's not clear yet. That might happen. But at the same time, in terms of our whole social services sector, as well as anything that is generated from consumer spending, which is two-thirds of our economy, we are likely to see some contractionary effect. So, of course, people will be more careful about spending. In certain sectors, we're likely to see price hikes. And what that's likely to mean is just more economic insecurity, especially at the bottom and in the middle.
Now, Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill was fired last week by President-elect George Bush. Some economists have suggested that Bush was not pleased with the war cost projections O'Neill had provided. What is your take on the O'Neill firing situation?
First of all, when people said that they fired the economic team, I was like, I didn't know they had one. I was really quite, they have not functioned as a team. Larry Lindsey, also the head of the Council of Economic Advisers, being fired. But these people have been mostly invisible. The president has put out his political team to talk about the efficacy of his tax cut, which I think is absolutely incorrect. And what you had the Treasury Secretary doing is looking more realistically at numbers. And the Nordhaus projections are very important because you see the big range there. You're talking about something, you know, billions of dollars as opposed to trillions of dollars. And when you look at that wide range, it reflects a number of things. How long will we be at war? And these are things we can't project. I mean, we're behaving as if this is going to be an in-and-out operation, which is what we thought about Vietnam as well. And so I think that Secretary O'Neill, I think that CEO Head Lindsey, were really trying to bring some clarity and some gravity to the situation. And Mr. Bush perceived them as not team players. The team players, in his opinion, are the people who simply reflect the White House line.
Dr. Julianne Malveaux, you have written a book that discusses the loyalty of African Americans and this war against terrorism. And you talk about a paradox. Tell us, what exactly is the paradox that you see?
Well, African American people, and especially African American men, have always fought for the right to fight. We have been, in my opinion, the most patriotic of Americans because patriotism is about dissent and about pointing up the contradictions. But no matter what ambivalence we felt about this country, black men have always, as you see with a Colin Powell or the history of a General Benjamin Davis, have always been there, been in the military, and wanted to be there. Indeed, our own very great W.B. Du Bois, at one point in World War I, exhorted black men to fight to prove their manhood. So black men went to fight and then came home to be lynched. And in the wake of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11th, you again saw African-American people being pushed to the periphery, being treated as if we were not Americans. And so in The Paradox of Loyalty, what Regina Green and I did was gathered 20 essays from people like Danny Glover, his statements on the death penalty, and Barbara Lee, her statement on the House of Congress, from John Edgar Wideman and Brian Gilmore, and of course our own essays about just this mixed feeling that black folks have and this notion that we cannot rush to war. I mean, our responses post-September 11th have been entirely wrong as a country, I feel. And I feel that what Mr. Bush did was he laid the foundation for this crazy notion of a war on Iraq, behaving as if we don't know the difference between Osama and Saddam.
I've seen a lot of African Americans waving flags and wearing red, white, and blue headbands and just, you know, expressing different and varying personal degrees of patriotism since September 11th. Is that a sentiment that you touch on in your book?
Oh, absolutely. One of the beautiful essays, Verna, is from a woman, Cheryl Poinsett Brown, a sister friend who's just a delightful writer and a military brat. And she writes about the red, white, and blue in juxtaposition to the Confederate flag. Because, you know, if you go south of D.C. into Virginia and into Georgia, where the Confederate flag made a difference in the composition of the Senate as well as the governor's race there, what she says is that if people are so patriotic, why is the Confederate flag still having so much sway? Yes, they're patriotic African-American people. How could you serve your country and not be patriotic? At the same time, the patriotism is one often undergirded by either cynicism or reality, understanding that while we may embrace the flag, and I say we figuratively because I certainly don't, and many certainly don't, but while many African-Americans embrace the flag does not embrace us. In fact, the cover of the book Paradox, I hope you've seen it, is a brother who is draped in the flag, but the Statue of Liberty has turned her back.
Sounds powerful. Do you see this war having any particular causing any particular casualties to communities of color throughout this nation?
There will be several layers of casualty. The first, of course, is that who fights in the front lines, who, you know, our voices have been silent by and large about this war. We have not been the people they call. Our experts are not the experts they're referring to, but when people come back in body bags, if people come back in body bags, we know that black and brown men will be the first ones that are called to go and that will go. And so that is one casualty. I think the other casualties all have to do with where we are in terms of economic development in communities of color. This is a time when we talk about wartime, when people do not want to talk about difference. They want to talk about being in the same boat. But if we're in the same boat, some folks are riding and some folks are rowing, and it's going to be communities of color that find their programs cut, that find access to education cut, public assistance cut. We're going through a higher education reauthorization, even as we talk about going to war, and one wonders how many funds will be available for Pell Grants and those kind of things. War is about austerity, and who experiences austerity first? Those at the bottom and at the periphery, and those are going to be communities of color.
And finally, Dr. Melvo, when we talk about the Confederate flag, one's mind these days certainly has to wander to the statement made by Senator Trent Lott with regard to Strom Thurmond. Wondering if you've had any thoughts about that situation.
Well, Trent Lott is from the same area of Mississippi that my mother is from, the Mississippi Gulf Coast, and he is so entirely out of step with reality that it's not funny. He has a history of these kinds of statements. He once said that while there was segregation in the Pascagoula area, which is, of course, where the Ingalls Shipyard is, that the black people were happy with that segregation. It is a disgrace that this man has a leadership position in the United States Senate. He should resign from his leadership position and, indeed, frankly, from the United States Senate. His comments about Strom Thurmond are the kind of sick and warped nostalgia that perpetuates the racial divide in our country. And I just shudder. Frankly, shudder at his temerity in making those statements in such a jocular tone and then in taking days to apologize and in offering a half-hearted apology. I wonder what Michael Steele, the lieutenant governor, recently elected lieutenant governor of Maryland, thinks about that. And I wonder what these African-Americans running around currying favor in the Republican Party think about one of their party leaders. But frankly, Trent Lott is why I'm absolutely frightened, petrified of Republicans and of the trifecta that Mr. Bush won in this last election with the Senate and the House and the White House and possibly the Supreme Court under the sway of a party that has leadership that will articulate support for segregation bodes ill for every African-American in this country.
Julianne Malveau is co-editor of The Paradox of Loyalty, an African-American Response to the War on Terrorism. Senator Trent Lott refused last night to resign his position for a statement he made last week at a birthday party for Strom Thurmond, a longtime segregationist. Lott said of Thurmond, quote, "We voted for you. We're proud of you. If he had been elected, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years," unquote. Lott has issued an apology. However, many continue to call for his resignation. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, we'll go to Chicago with more on how Bush's war could take an even higher toll on communities of color.